From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Thanks for joining us. This is tick season. Seems like we're hearing a lot about Lyme disease and ticks more often. And it makes sense. Climate change has increased the population of ticks. If you've been bitten by a tick, it's best to try to remove the tick and check in with your doctor. Lyme disease is very real and could be serious.
But here's where things get controversial. While Lyme disease is real, chronic Lyme disease is not, according to most mainstream doctors and medical researchers. In other words, once you find out you have Lyme disease, you can treat it with antibiotics at any stage. Some patients think they have long-term chronic cases of Lyme, but doctors say almost certainly they don't. Their symptoms might actually be evidence of chronic fatigue syndrome, arthritis, or something else.
Patients who believe they have chronic Lyme disease are angry with this idea, and they've taken to calling many doctors Lyme illiterate. In fact, the doctor who discovered Lyme disease is now called Lyme illiterate. We welcomed an expert on infectious diseases, Dr. Jeffrey Weinberg from URMC, to explain why the medical establishment does not put much stock in the idea of chronic Lyme disease.
Well, I'm afraid, as with many things, that there's truth on both sides, and people just have to step back and be a little more polite. I am probably considered Lyme illiterate by many people because I'm in the mainstream scientific medicine. And yet, as you mentioned, there are many people who suffer from some sort of illness. The difference is that over history, there have always been people suffering from diseases which were not yet smart enough to diagnose. So 20 years ago, there were people who were said to be sufferers of chronic EBV infection. And before that, it was chronic yeast infection. And before that, it was chronic staph. And even as far back in the 1920s, it was chronic brucellosis, or a term myalgic encephalitis, which still sort of survives as a possible synonym to chronic fatigue syndrome. Chronic fatigue syndrome itself is a hard diagnosis to figure out, and some people, including the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, and the Institute of Medicine, are asking us to call it by a different name. We can get into that. But I think many of the people who have what we call post-treatment Lyme disease symptoms are probably feeling ill still. The question is whether it's ill because of the Lyme disease, or whether this is a response of the body that can happen after so many different infections. And the importance of that is post-treatment Lyme disease symptoms may need therapy, but the therapy, if it's not an infection, does not include antibiotics, which have their own risks. So I think the differences of both sides are that there is truth in the middle, but that people get, admittedly, some of us in the medical establishment may get frustrated and turn people off and tell them to get with the plan and just go on. And that naturally will turn off a lot of patients. On the other hand, patients are, I think, sometimes looking for one pill, one antibiotic to make things better. And that's probably as inappropriate as physicians telling them to get with the plan.
So starting with the idea of let's be more polite on all sides.
I think absolutely.
Have you been harassed, or have you heard from patients who, let me back up and ask you, first of all, as you say, the population of patients who do believe that they have chronic Lyme disease would probably call you Lyme illiterate. The doctor who essentially discovered and first diagnosed Lyme disease from Yale, what was his name?
Dr. Alan Steer.
He is known as Lyme illiterate.
Yes,
which is an amazing
thing. Camp. Yes.
It's an amazing thing. The doctor who discovered Lyme disease is now Lyme illiterate. But I want to ask if that offends you. Does that bother you?
Well, it's an offensive term, certainly, but I haven't been personally harassed. I have been disbelieved and called illiterate. And in fact, several years ago in our National Conference of Infectious Disease Specialists, the Infectious Disease Society of America and the Pediatric Infectious Disease Society, both organizations of which I'm a fellow, an advanced fellow, we were all picketed and we had to cross picket lines of people who were driving buses saying, IDSA is anti-patient, you know, our society kills people. And that's really quite upsetting for a physician who's used to, who basically we've all devoted our lives to treating people. So it's upsetting, but I mean, thankfully, I haven't been personally harassed and hope not to be after this show.
And to be clear, Lyme disease is very much a real thing. It's chronic Lyme disease that is in question. But Lyme disease, what are the symptoms of Lyme disease?
The trouble is Lyme disease is a strange, as you mentioned, it's a spirochetal infection, and it goes through many phases over several years. And so early on, it is really predominantly a rash after the tick bite, an expanding red circular rash that enlarges quite a bit, even to several inches. In the middle phase, months after the tick bite, you might have, and children particularly, I'm a pediatrician, so I talk mostly about children. In children, we particularly have paralysis of the facial nerve, or what's called a facial nerve palsy, where one side of the face may droop, or you may get meningitis, or headaches, or even more rash. And then months to years later is when we see the arthritis. That is what Dr. Steer originally identified at Yale, New Haven. But and so all of that is real. The lesson we try to teach is all of it is also eminently treatable by antibiotics.
At any stage.
And antibiotics at any stage will prevent future stages. So not only do antibiotics early on tend to resolve things, but they prevent the future stages. The problem is this post-treatment Lyme syndrome that some people have, maybe 5% or so of people, is distinctly different. It doesn't continue with the known infectious pathogenesis that we expect with ongoing
So what do you
infection.
Think is going on there? And is that question even valid to you? Is this a case where we simply need more research to understand?
Oh, I think we need plenty of research still.
Could it be chronic Lyme disease?
Well, there's no precedence for it is the trouble. I mean, syphilis used to do this too. If syphilis was untreated, syphilis could go on for years and cause a wealth of different signs and symptoms. And of course, it's a spirochetal disease as well. But when penicillin was brought out in the 1940s and 50s, it was realized that you could treat syphilis at any stage and prevent further damage.
Now let's shift to a conversation about guns, specifically the libertarian viewpoint on guns. We welcomed RIT political science professor Lauren Hall, a libertarian who was very direct about the trade-offs that libertarians are willing to make on this issue.
This clip starts with Evan asking about the relationship between guns and gun deaths.
Wherever you see more guns, you see more gun death. That's just something that is true, whether we like it or not. And my guess is libertarians don't like limits on guns. And so I will start with Professor Hall. Is this a trade-off that we accept from the libertarian perspective, that if you allow the freedom to own guns, you have to accept that you're going to be in a society with more gun death?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's always trade-offs. So with freedom comes increased risk in a variety of kinds of ways. At the same time, I think that we can argue that a lot of the gains in human safety that we've seen over the last 10,000 years has been a result of capitalism. The fact that we can now peacefully trade with people who normally we would have speared to death in a field somewhere. So there's always going to be trade-offs. Now, that being said, I think that there's kind of a constitutional question and a broader sort of libertarian question. I'm a little bit agnostic on the sort of libertarian question. I think prohibiting guns by themselves is going to have very little effect on some of the kinds of things that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. I do think that there are common sense regulations that we can put into place. I don't think people should be able to own grenade launchers or, you know, machine guns. And it's certainly true that a lot of the kinds of things that people have pointed to, a lot of the policy shifts, would not have prevented a lot of the kinds of recent mass shootings that we are concerned
about. But why not
about.
Machine guns? Why can't I have a machine gun?
Well, and again, I think that this is where I'm going to differ from, and I hope people will see this in Phil's response, and I think, you know, Kevin would agree with this, that libertarianism is what we call a big tent kind of movement. And so people, principled libertarians, I think, can disagree on this point. There's principled libertarians that think that the role of gun ownership is to protect you against the state, in which case, yes, you need tanks, you need machine guns, you need grenade launchers. There's other libertarians who think, well, actually, we can kind of do that and just have rifles or handguns. I think that there are some actually really interesting libertarian solutions to the problem of gun violence that are not being floated by either of the other parties.
For example?
For example, insuring guns. So you insure your car. If I get into an accident with my car, I have insurance that that protects other people from the harm that is done. If you insured guns in the same way that you insure cars, but then also you hold people criminally liable for the harm that is done with their gun. I'm held criminally liable for, or I'm held liable in a variety of ways for the harm that is done by my car. Why not make it so that if you leave your gun out and it kills a small child, you have to pay that child's family money. You have to make amends in a variety of ways. It would make people, it would provide incentives. Libertarians are big on incentives. It would provide incentives for people to make sure that their guns are locked up and taken care of safely. So I'm a little bit agnostic on sort of where I think the principled position on things like machine guns should be. I don't see a real decent reason for people to own them. But I do think that we can do gun regulation in a much more commonsensical way than we are thinking about it now, which is outlawing assault style weapons when really that's sort of a meaningless term. We don't really define our terms very well in this debate. And again, I think it's important to go back to this broader question of the fact that we are living in the safest time ever and that the media plays a role in making these kinds of events much more salient.
Yeah, I'm with you, but I worry that the argument breaks down when you say you can't figure out what people really have reason to hold a machine gun for. Well, what if it's just fun to me? In a free society, yeah. I can't have fun. I can't go out in the backyard and use a machine gun to shoot a bunch of Coke cans. I'm not going to shoot my neighbors. You're going to take their... just because I have a shouldered fired missile doesn't mean I'm taking down an airplane. Mm-hmm. I might just go skeet shooting with a shoulder fired missile. Why can't I?
Yeah, no, and again, I think that there are certain kinds of guns, and there's actually been some really interesting sort of philosophic discussions of gun rights that deal with this question, and a lot of them point to, you know, what is the potential for harm? So you could potentially have a machine gun in your backyard and set up a range in such a way that you would minimize damage to other people. That would be harder to do in a grenade launcher kind of situation unless you have a lot of land, and maybe that could be some kind of way that we parse this out, right? You have to have at least 10 acres to own a grenade launcher. You know, I don't know what sort of makes sense in that area. But I don't think part of this gets back to the fact that the U.S. culture is, I mean, we've always been a gun-owning people. And I do think there's something to the argument that you hear on the right, although I'm not going to support the NRA in a variety of ways or for a variety of reasons. But the fact that the kinds of mass shootings that we're seeing in the United States are also indicative of a certain kind of cultural problem, and I don't know what that is, but there's a very serious, deeply rooted problem that is not necessarily linked to guns, even though guns are obviously the way in which that problem is being expressed.
And now let's hear from one of the most well-regarded environmental activists in the country. Fred Tutman lives and works on the Patuxent River in Maryland, but he also helps grassroots groups organize across the country. And he's coming to Rochester to consult with residents in Rochester's Plex neighborhood. That's Plymouth Exchange.
In this clip, Tutman says big business has a history of running roughshod over communities and the environment. And he says most of the time, money wins out.
Frankly, people get real. These developers or these opposing forces, they get pretty real in front of a judge. Mind you, we don't always win, and you know the judges don't care for us much either. They think we're inconveniencing these big rich corporations. But the uncertainty of a court proceeding is also a powerful tool that brings the parties to the table, such that you can either negotiate in some cases, or you know it slows down the project itself. I mean, there are lots of ways you can use that legal presence to bring up short an objectionable development where the parties are, you know, they don't have the same level of power. So I know maybe that sounds a little vague, but like I said, like you said earlier, there's no one-off. There's no one solution. If you have the point of view, on the other hand, that all of these applicants who want to build stuff and put in industrial facilities in historic districts and, you know, big box stores and floodplains and in ravines, I mean, that's what we're talking about. Sometimes we're talking about just plain bad policy. We're not talking about not in my backyard. We're talking about projects that are objectionable on their face because they're discordant with the surrounding community. And that comes up a lot, a concrete batching plant in the middle of a bucolic neighborhood, simply because the applicant could get the zoning that they wanted. Right. So for the most part, we're dealing with right encroachments from institutions that don't have an involvement with the community. They're proceeding on the basis of some vested or invested right where they feel they can overwhelm and redefine the character of the community for their own purposes.
I think that last point's probably underrated or underconsidered in a lot of these fights. And I think about fracking in the Finger Lakes, where there was so much organization and real grassroots opposition that helped swing that tide a few years ago. But I remember talking to to Rick Rainey, one of the really smart people in the wine industry down there. Though Rick's wife might disagree, hello, Rick and Dewey, if you're listening. But Rick said to me one day, he said, you know, there's a lot of concern about what happens if fracking goes wrong for the environment, for water tables, for all kinds of things. But let's just say you could guarantee there was never going to be a problem. What if you could build a factory in Yellowstone and be guaranteed there would never be one bit of pollution or a problem? Is that still the place for it? Do you still want to put huge cranes and massive trucks and sort of this big, ugly blight in an industry that is bucolic and is agricultural and tourism-based? He said, even if you can guarantee me nothing would ever go wrong, it's just not the place for it. And so that was an interesting, I think, and maybe underrated part of the argument to begin with. So that's why I appreciate Fred's kind of keying on the multiple levels of why people push back on some of these products. Not just because it's always going to be doom and gloom, but sometimes it's not the right place for it. And I wonder, Fred, about compromise. So I want to ask you a little bit about where your view on compromise is. And I brought up the pollution credits. Can you tell us a little bit about what pollution credits are and how you viewed that in one particular case for a little bit of a reference there?
So this is an idea, the idea of pollution trading that has popped up both in air and lately in water. And it's leveraged by the idea that I think part of it is you can't beat them, join them. In other words, using market solutions is kind of the generic term. The problem I have with the idea of buying and trading credits, basically you're selling the right to pollute, is that it absolutely short circuits the ability of local citizens to detect a violation, right? Because in fact, what you're looking at of that discharge pipe, it might actually be a trading transaction where someone's getting paid to sell some surplus credits from their existing permit, if you can kind of picture that scenario. But the biggest problem I have with it is that watersheds and the planet are not markets. These are not marketplaces. These are actually public trust resources. The moment you start treating them like markets, you know, to me, a market would be like in a shopping mall. That's where the market is, right? But if we're talking about air, water, and land, these are things that are above markets and need to be held apart from markets. So I think that's a phenomenon, this idea of pollution trading, which incidentally has a lot of support within the environmental community. Are folks who have a sense that their environmentalism is integrally connected with money, that they can't imagine cleaning up the environment unless there's a lot of money involved, or that's how they keep score. Right? I mean, to the extent that environmentalism for some has become a professional endeavor, then while people aren't motivated by money, they do want the attainment of getting a big paycheck that goes along with it, or benefits, or the ability to pay their bills. So the money becomes a part of the consideration. And the point I was making earlier, I think, is that grassroots doesn't have that consideration at all. We're just fighting for love. Forget the money. We're fighting for what's real to us. We don't really want to hear about someone's money's at stake, or, you know, what the worth of the, you know, we don't want to put a value. We don't want to put a price tag on the wetlands.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. Where is it? Here we go. How's that sound? Good. We had a very serious conversation about ticks, but I just want to say I'm excited that a new live-action version of the tick is back.
I was wondering if that would make it into our conversations this week.
Do you know the ticks, the comic book character, the ticks, rallying cry?
I don't.
Spoon!
Great. Well, thanks for listening to...
if we were smarter, we would have pulled a clip of the tick yelling spoon. But anyway, I'm going to say goodbye now. You can hear Connections, WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Spoon.
We will talk to you Monday.